All right, welcome back to the Hero Mindset Podcast. Today, we have an amazing guest. His name is Dr. Todd Cashton. He is he's a clinical psychologist and a prolific, that's what I'll say, a prolific researcher who I came across a year or two ago and I absolutely love. And so I'm glad that he's here with us today on the next episode of the Hero Mindset Podcast. So Todd, why don't you tell us what you're up to, what you got going on these days, and we're excited to hear from you.
Yeah, no, thanks. So I founded the Wellbeing Laboratory before it was cool back in 1999. And then right now we are in the midst of, I've got a new book on purpose in life, The Science of It, a handbook, thinking of all of us who didn't have male role models or really good female role models as a kid, the graduate in from high school, college, people that are trying to pivot midlife, which is a big thing right now with all the technology and machinery. I just want to put every, I want to die empty. I want to have every neuron's ideas on a book, in an article, in a research study somewhere so that I can feel content in my crematorium or whatever the hell my kids are going to do for me. So we've got the purpose book coming out. We have two models of purpose in life. There haven't been that many models of purpose in life since Viktor Frankl, which I'm sure we'll touch upon. And we have a new model of curiosity that builds off of our last one. Again, not that many models are coming out. And the way I like to do this is, what can we do with science that will get tools and strategies into people's hands? Not just a neurobiological model of how curiosity operates in the pituitary and hippocampus and ventral striatum of the brain, but what behaviorally do you do around other people with your curiosity that makes you amazing and annoying, which fits very nice with the hero mindset.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning the hero mindset, you know, and that's what I found, you know, when I first, I think somebody, it was another guy named Alan Allard who used to practice, who was a clinical psychologist, and he had sent me an article over a year or so ago. And then that's how you and I got hooked up. But, you know, when you talk about your research and moving beyond the hippocampus and all these, you know, these areas in the brain, that's what I loved about your research is that it's, of course, it's, you know, it's empirical and it's peer reviewed and that's good, but it seemed applicable. And it's about things, and what resonated with me is because as I'm finishing my dissertation, as you know, on the experiences of how army culture influences those three constructs of the interpersonal theory of suicide, you know, I found your stuff resonated with me because you're talking about purpose, you're talking about curiosity, and what happens when, you know, when somebody has such resolve that they can override all the biological mechanisms meant for survival, and they can harm themselves. And to me, that ties right along with lack of purpose, lack of curiosity, all those things that you're talking about. The upside of your dark side was probably, I see it in the background there, was one of my favorite books, because all these things that you're doing talk about like the environment, and we forget sometimes that how much effect the environment has on us.
No. Thank you. Thank you for all that. And thank you for your dissertation, which is like that. If you think about that model, right? So one of the big factors for people that are listening that don't know about this model is the biggest factor of the three is perceived burdensomeness. You feel as if you're a burden on other people. And so in some ways, if you have a clear directive or a mission for what you do on a day-to-day basis, you don't feel burdensome at all. You feel as if, like, hey, if you're not going to use your days, if you're not going to use your hours next door, give them to me, because I need more time to, I want to create kids that are great conversationalists. I want to go into lower, you know, lower income neighborhoods and create like sports leagues to kind of get them out of these kind of systems where they don't have good role models to work with. I want to like build some kind of system where Panera and Chick-fil-A, when they have leftover food, how do we make sure it gets to people quickly because it decomposes? You know, when you have missions, purposes, there's no room for burdensome. So if you know, I don't want to simplify it, but if you want to think about how do we reduce suicidal ideations, self-injurious behaviors, and at the worst case, people actually committing or taking their own lives. It's when people have a purpose, they don't think that way because they're like, I need my energy because it's already preordained for someone or something. And so, and I appreciate the kind words. When I think about our models that we're creating a purpose, we're thinking about it like this. I was just reading an article about Hurricane Katrina yesterday, which I have not, I don't know about you, but I have not read one in the past 10 years just because
Yeah, probably.
it was so intense. And we watched the videos of, boats passing by, bodies that were kind of floating past them that, and it's also not my life. So I should probably say is like, there is a level of unfair distancing that happens, but it's like so stressful. And then I read this article yesterday and it was talking about how, so I don't know New Orleans that well. If you know it better, feel free. Or if there's a listener that wants to correct me, feel free as well.
Yeah.
That the way that New Orleans is structured is there's like a dividing line. I don't know the name of the street. I think it actually might be Desire, might be the name of the street, or Abundance. They have a lot of these like beautiful wellness phrases that are the titles of streets in the worst areas in terms of police protection, crime, criminal activity, drug use. And then so the backing of this terrible precinct in New Orleans, because of the fact of it's just basically there's no protection and safety, is a golf course. But the golf course, the back wall of the golf course is so high with so many barbed wire levels of the fence that the people that are in the low income neighborhood are seeing the fence but do not realize an entirely another economic and social strata of high aspirations exists right attached in their neighborhood. They can't see in, and then the rich and wealthy in this golf course can't see out to realize, oh shoot, there is something more meaningful than getting pissed off because I did not hit a birdie on the 12th hole that happens there. And I just think, what a great physical, geographical, like metaphor for, we have so many sources of meaning and purpose, so many venues to go into, and it could be right next to us, but we don't have access for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you said that, it made me think of an event I was part of the other day called Tough Conversations. And so Alan Weiss asked me, he says, "So TJ, from your experience, what's a tough conversation?" And I said, "Well, from my experience, or one I'm anticipating having." He says, "From your experience." And I said, "Well, I've had to call family members and tell them that their service member died, or that they attempted suicide." And I say that because when you gave that analogy of the fence and, the bad neighborhood, so, or the less desirable neighborhood up against, separated, by a fence with this, higher socioeconomic, area, I didn't think, when he asked me that and I said it, and then something he said afterwards, he says, "Well, that certainly makes all conversations a lot easier, doesn't it?" And I said, "Yes." And one time he told me, because I told him I was afraid to, I wasn't afraid, but I was trying to talk to the fire chief because he said it here in our local community because he was having issues with resilience in the organization. And I totally psyched myself out, didn't go talk. And I was sharing this with Alan, and he messaged back and he says, "So you mean to tell me you can go to war and you can do all these things and you can experience death and destruction, but you're afraid to talk to somebody?" And so when you said that about the fence, we all have the proverbial fence in our lives that make us think that we're, it's not impossible, but, and that's where I think about behavior and environment because, and one of the best teachers of that I've seen is working with kids. As I'm going through my clinical rotations, right, so I'm finishing up practicum, going into internship. And Dr. Rivers puts a lot of kids on my calendar. And at first I was like dreading it because, and then I was like, "Oh no, this is amazing," because you can't, what we're, you have to involve the environment. You have to consider everything. It's not, with an adult, there's some, maybe, less so, environment's still important, but a kid is totally dependent upon the people that are taking care of them or not taking care of them or providing these inputs.
Yeah, this is the article that I wrote in my Substack yesterday about this paper that was published in Science showing that the brain of a child that's in an impoverished environment looks near identical to someone that has been very heavily involved in terms of possibly addiction to the amphetamine family of psychoactive substances, or someone that's had basically chronic insomnia. This could be like parents with young children. It could be just you have you're having like a night shift and you're trying to change your circadian rhythm, and so their brains look like someone that is facing chronic stress and unable to actually have the biopsychosocial resources to think clearly, make decisions, and then if this is how your brain is operating, as if you're an adult with 2 hours of sleep a day, and anyone with infants will tell you, yeah, those are the worst times of my life. Although I love my kids, they're whole both in ones. Well, then how do you say no to someone that says, hey, listen, if you join our gang, then we're going to offer you protection. If you don't take these drugs, we're going to come after you. We're going to freaking harm your family. You can't think of the long-term, short-term costs and benefits for two-by-two matrix. You got four sections you have to complete in your head. If you are sleep deprived, if you are on amphetamine, if you are in an impoverished environment, and this is how your brain operates, you just say yes to, thumbs up to not experiencing suffering, and thumbs down to anything that basically is going to make me not enjoy the present moment because I don't know what's left for me.
That's when you were describing that, it's almost like a variant of of PTSD, right? And you start and those gangs become replacements for all the attachment, the lack of
Yeah.
attachment or the inappropriate attachment we have. One of the things that I do now kind of as a standard practice when I'm working with kids before I'll even see them, if it's for therapy, is I send over a parent interview, some questions for the parent to ask. I send over that attachment, and I have them fill it out before they come, to their first session, because these attachment issues and stuff are critically important to what's going on or how they develop. It's good information. And when you talked about gangs, that made me think, so you got people, who didn't have the appropriate attachment relationships as they're growing up, and this is what it's offering. In spite of the fact that, and another way to look at it is these gangs are demonstrating their value, right? If we think about it in terms of value, they're showing potential members, people that they're recruiting, the value that they offer, and that value is protection. It's being part of a group. All the things that sometimes we don't get when mom has to work all the time, and I was thankful that, even though my parents divorced early, and my mom was a single parent, my dad was still, in my life, and my grandparents were there. So when mom or dad couldn't be there, they were always there to backstop. So I was still able to develop those relationships. But we don't have that. Some people don't have those opportunities.
So TJ, you know we have the exact same family background. Parents divorced at two, dad walked out, mom was a single mom, she passed away, I was raised by my grandparents. Same exact thing. The reason that I love your story that you just told right now is because we tend to think of, well, look at you, TJ. Like, you're in a doctor program, you survived the military, you're white. Your guy, like you're good to go. And I really do like the fact of thinking of, hey, just two sentences of your biographical background, and all of a sudden people are like, oh, I can relate to you. And then like it's going back to tough conversations, difficult conversations, is if we can just wait for, hey, three salient details of your background before I make a judgment call of, should I be listening to you? Could you understand me? Are you worth my time and effort? Would I want to collaborate with you? Just wait, like wait for the three details that you get ahead of time. But to return back to that model, the three-dimensional model of suicidal risk. And so you think about, well, what do gangs do? So you have your it thwarts the concerns about belonging. So that's one of the dimensions. The perceived burdensome burdensomeness disappears because the gang is saying, you're not a burden. Join us. Like, you have skills, capacities, abilities. This might be the first time a kid hears it. And so they're like, wow, someone sees that I have value in the world. And then the third one is the most complicated one, probably beyond this phone call, is the realized capacity that you can tolerate a lot of pain. Well, the gang basically dilutes your need to experience pain and suffering, because if someone messes with you, the gang jumps in. So you'll never test your capacity for what you can tolerate, because you know of people that truly physically have your back that happens there. And so I think it's unfortunate. I know this is like such a strange direction for this conversation. I think it's
It's great.
unfortunate where people have political orientations where they have these automatic assumptions of gangs are bad, and thus people that are in the gangs are bad. And if there's one takeaway that's really useful for this conversation, is the gangs might be bad, but don't blame the individuals that are in them, because, as you said, they are serving as surrogates for psychological needs and attachment you might not have met. And if anything, you should be blaming yourself, the one that's making the judgment about kids or adults in gangs, and asking yourself, what have you done to make sure that the psychological needs of people that are lesser off than you are being satisfied? If not, hold your judgment and try to help the individuals. Don't try to help the gang get world prominence. Help the individuals in the gang.
Well, what you said about, the role of the gang, but I mean, that's the case with any adaptive mechanism or coping mechanism. Whether you resort to substance abuse or alcohol use or I don't know, spending money, whatever it is. I mean, it could be cleaning the house repetitively. I mean, OCD we know is an anxious. It has its roots in anxiety and in fear, right? My point was is whether it's joining a gang or it's any of those, we're not doing it because we want to screw ourselves, because we want to screw up and end up in jail for 10 years. We're doing it because at first we see it as the simplest way to get what we need. It's a defensive mechanism. We're defending ourselves. We're trying to protect ourselves, and so. But we all know that coping mechanisms can become maladaptive when we fail to see that they've outlived their usefulness, right?
And then
So
if you
you
go,
said that.
and then if you go beyond PTSD and you work towards post-traumatic growth, well, once you have the defenses available for you, and in this case, we're talking about in the human form as being part of a gang. Well, now I can see, just like someone that goes through, a combat zone as a, in the military, and just realizes, like, oh my God, I didn't realize how much I persevere. I didn't realize how courageous I am. I didn't realize how much compassion I have for the other people here, where I would do anything to protect them and risk my own life that happens there. When you're in a gang, it could be the very first time where you realize, holy cow, I am curious, exploratory, adventurous. Like, I am constantly trying to learn new things. Like you said, learn about this environment so I can make better prediction models, so I can respond quicker if there's a threat or a reward. And that might be the first time, not school, because teachers don't the best they don't get the best teachers in these areas of the country or the world. And so you realize, shoot, I have this amazing matrix of strengths, and I am grateful that the gang provided me a forum to do that. So maladaptive in terms of it's not a net positive for society, but adaptive, as you're saying, and a net positive for the individual. And so if you don't replace it, you don't get someone out.
And so it's funny that you not it's ironic, I guess is a better term, that you talked about that we related this to PTSD and gangs, because I'll tell you, so recently as I'm going through the VA process, I was, I had to, you do all these exams. And so I'm with this therapist for this clinic, and I think it was, so the PCL5, the one the VA uses for screening for PTSD. And as we both know, like 30 is clinical is seen as clinically significant, and this guy goes, "Oh shit, And I said, "What?" And he says, "Well, you're like an 80." He says, "I've never seen it this high." I said, "Oh." And when you talked about, I say that to say, because when you talk about, coping mechanisms and how we've learned, whether we believe it or not, to persevere. And it was then when he said that, when I was able to realize, oh man, I've just been, as we say in the army, pushing through the kill zone, meaning, and it wasn't until I got back here and started my retirement, and then, I'm going through these exams that I was able to see that, that's why I've been, you're so tired, the brain fog, the
Right.
because you're just constantly in this, well, you're constantly in a stressful environment, because you're because the amygdala is not flushing out those memories, and it's keeping trigger, and so you're constantly hyper, vigilant. And I tell this story to be funny, but I get frustrated when I can only find 7.5 socks, and not eight pair. Like we're like who invaded the house and steals socks or
Once.
pieces of Lego? Yeah, I mean, who, where? This is not, logical. But I say that because that going back to our story of gangs and exposure to stress, what we're learning is that, the DSM has a very kind of black and white perspective of trauma, especially PTSD. There's the criterion A, the main, right, don't pass go without a criterion A symptoms in terms of the PTSD. And then there's the notion that it needs to onset within 6 months, or we consider delayed onset. But now what I'm seeing, and this has taken more, gotten more traction in Europe, but still not reflected in the diagnostic manuals and stuff, is complex trauma. And what we're seeing, and that's what I think is the gist of the stories that you and I are talking about today, is this complex trauma. It's not the one and done. Hey, I saw, Todd get ran over by a car and have both his legs amputated when we were, playing outside at 10 years old, right? It's what soldiers have experienced, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, especially post 9/11, this constant almost re-exposure, I mean, actual re-exposure. I'm not talking about intrusive memories, dreams, and stuff like that. I'm talking about you're constantly going back to warfare. You're constantly, it wasn't just happening one time. And that's what's happening with kids and other people in these environments. It doesn't let up. You're constantly in the, you're constant, like you said, you're constantly on the other side of that fence, so to speak, right? You're constantly in that fight or flight mode. And I think that's interesting, and that relates to that the what we see empirically with veterans is that first 12 months after they leave service is the deadliest. It's when they're most likely to have, to experience suicidality. And when you talked about acquired capability earlier, that third construct,
Oh yeah,
I think
veterans have that in spades.
they do, because we've been desensitized through exposure to employ lethal means as a course of action.
Yeah, just for people that are listening, I always like to add a third group to this, and that is people that are in abusive
Oh
relationships.
yeah.
They often don't meet. I really like the way you phrase it, where A is kind of the gateway, but you don't have an A. So you aren't punched until you are unconscious. You aren't sent to the ER. You got pushes, shoves, plates thrown against walls. So none of it meets criterion A for post-traumatic stress disorder. But you have this like week after week and then year after year. And then guess what? You have this thing that we're talking about here. It just ends up being is that as scientists, we're a little bit robotic and we're kind of like, all right, these are the very strict diagnostic criteria, but this is what PTSD looks like, is like when you are hypervigilant and unable to control it, and you're in a grocery store and all of a sudden you hear the sound of footsteps too quick or too slow, whatever it is you're experiencing in your household, and all of a sudden it is as if someone is about to push you. Your body responds as if you are. Well, that's what PTSD looks like, and it's There are two things that are happening. One I like, one I don't like. So one I don't like is that we are overly diagnosing ourselves because we have access to, all this AI agents that say, hey, here's what I'm experiencing. You use your microphone and it says, sounds like PTSD. And so then guess what? Very quickly, you don't look, you're looking for confirmation. And so you don't check to say, hey, can you do a critical analysis of whether I don't have PTSD? Now, most people don't do that extra question of I want you to be a critic. I want you to assume your first diagnosis was wrong. So we have a lot of therapy speak entering into the world, which is excessive. On the positive side is because the science is now available through Google Scholar and anyone can get the science that goes in there, people can now have phrases to describe, oh, this is the experience I have with my partner. I couldn't figure out like what, maybe there's something wrong with me. And it's like, no, you are so finely attuned to the gradients of how they think and how they talk to see, like, oh, that's the word they'd often use. Your brain picks it up of a threat is probably coming real soon. I better be very obsequious. That's what PTSD kind of looks like. And even if we don't call it PTSD, that is what trauma-related experiences do. And you don't, you're not outside of that box just because you don't have the big kahuna event that has a as a physical scar on your face.
Right. I think that's, and that's where this, as I go through and I finish my training, is the and thankful to have a great supervisor in Dr. Rivers, because, she's constantly encouraging me to, she's use your clinical judgment. A couple weeks ago, and you see this with things like ASD, autism spectrum disorder. I think those are that's another one of the big ones that we see diagnosed a lot.
Yeah.
And so we had this, we were conducting this assessment, and I'm getting ready to write the report, and she comes by my office and she says, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I mean, he's another psychologist had assessed them, thinks he has. Just go back and read it though. As none that diagnosis was based solely on the report of the parents. The ADOS was like a one, which means he's not to, just to go back and think about how he interacted with us and the, and the, how conversational he was.
Nice.
And so I guess my point is not everything's going to fit in a nice little box. There's a
Yeah.
difference. We need to get resources to people. People need resources, whether they fit in the box or not. And, when you're talking about whether it's like EMDR therapy for people with PTSD, or ABA services for people that we believe have some type of, ASD, getting resources to people, in my mind, should be the priority. The diagnosis is just gives us a, it helps us. It tells us what's the, it's kind of like training tells you how to think, education tells you, or training tells you what to think, education teaches you how to think. And so I look at the diagnosis, is it just gives us, as we would say in the Army, a grid, a 6-digit versus a 8-digit grid coordinate. It helps us get a little closer to what may be going on. But in my experience, people rarely meet the criteria for any of these diagnoses that makes you like, 100% sure. I mean, whether it's from psychosis to that's a whole nother thing, but people rarely fall into these frameworks or whatever that we want them. There's always going to be exceptions to the rule, right? And I think your point is made me think that, the key is getting resources to people that need it.
Yeah, and then there's a thread here that you're I love what your supervisor mentor said to you is that just having this element of curiosity which involves healthy skepticism. And I think sometimes it gets a bad rep and people think of like, well, you can't question someone who has more credentials and experience than you. And it's no, anyone can, but you have to lay your cards out in terms of what is the evidence for and against. And so most people just be like, no, they're wrong. Well, that's not interesting at all, other than the fact
No.
is you have quick judgments. That's great. But so, one of the
Yeah.
things is one of the things which is it's this is why we should get paid the big money, but we don't get paid the big money as therapists is to say, What are the secondary gains for the parents to want this diagnosis? You should always be asking that question. Now, you're not condemning the parents, you're not criticizing them. It's just, we care so much about the welfare of your kid that this is a question that's on our. Now, you wouldn't ask it that way, but you want to figure out, like, is there a reason? I have a friend of mine who went through a pretty disgusting divorce, and she is constantly unable to manage the normal adolescent behavior of her kids. And she realized that, you know, if I medicate my kids, they are obsequious, they're quiet, they're simple, they respond to everything in a positive way. This is great. And so she got a diagnosis. She did not ask the other parents' permission. She had asked, as you to your point. So you have, for a kid who's around 11 to 13 years of age, if the only report you have that there is a disorder or mental health problem that requires a psychoactive substance, the only report is one of two parents, not a self-report, no teacher report, no peer reports, no independent evaluations, like your mentor was saying. How did they talk to you? How conversational were they? How good were they at responding to you when you gave them prompts? What did they do on unprompted? What did they do in responding to when you solicited information? And so they got it. She got a diagnosis from just her report and put her kid on meds. And then I, as you know, just offering consultation, was like, that's not how you do child diagnosis. And you have to ask the question, why does this parent want this diagnosis and these meds so bad and skip therapy? And just take that for everything that has serious consequences, repercussions, and have that healthy skepticism.
Well, I think, it's great because I reflect upon my own journey. And if I would have not had input from others, I probably never would have gotten the treatment that I needed. And it's ongoing, right? Because despite what my therapist may say, who I told him I disagree with, PTSD treatment and many treatments are not one and done, right? Because what you're trying to do, I mean, sure, maybe some of the EMDR stuff, you're trying to get rid of some of the more urgent, maybe emergent issues, right? You're trying to get them to a baseline where they can operate more effectively, right? Where they can start to build that capacity that I talk about in the hero mindset, where, and it's not, and it doesn't feel like every day is, is D-Day and you're landing on Normandy, right? And so if I wouldn't have had input from other colleagues and people that I trusted, I would have never thought that I met the criterion, and I know the criterion, fairly well for PTSD, because I didn't think that my memories were, intrusive, or I didn't think that, I just knew that I couldn't never, I was always on edge. I was always irritable. And I thought, okay, maybe you're just an asshole, I mean, I didn't, like, why? Okay, I was a sergeant major in the Army. That's why when things aren't, exactly right, that's so I'm irritated. Because, and then the other thing was, I look at, I could never, after I came home from Kuwait this last time, I never felt like, there was the, what do they call it? The depersonalization, the derealization, the fact that I could never, I kind of described it as like a colicky baby. They can never be soothed in terms of, even if I was around people that I liked and I enjoyed, I didn't, I felt disconnected. I would have never, until somebody mentioned it and I went to, to get screened, I never would have thought that I met the, I would have met the criteria. And it was that insight from others that helped me. At the same time, I'm adamant about the fact that you have to keep pushing through, the kill zone. And what we talk about exposure therapies and stuff right now, it's all the rage. Every day I have 5, 10, 20 emails from PESI advocating for that I need to take some type of CPEs they have for some type of trauma exposure therapy or something, right? But I will I will offer this, and I've said this to you before. The Army's been doing exposure therapy probably since 1776, 1775, you know, and when the Continental Army was formed. And so, you know, just to say you can't, the only way to get through some of these things, the only way to get through the kill zone, to push through the kill zone is on in is to get through it, is to not get slowed down, to not get bogged down. You have to maintain that momentum. But you know, that's hard when, you know, I would bump into my wife in the hallway at the house or something, or she would get, you know, too close in a confined area. And I'm like, and I always until recently described it as being overstimulated, right? But I never, but that's because I didn't really know any other way to say it. But now I can go back and relate to it. It's, you know, it was that sense of, you know, fear, you know, there's that, you know, essentially my body, my amygdala was telling me, hey, there's, you know, there's a threat here, right? And so once you know and you get that information from the more people you can get that information from, you know, and get some insight from, I think the better off we are. But going with one off, I mean, you know, people come, you know, one client, you know, comes and thinks their kids, you know, depressed or whatever. And I'm reluctant to, you know, you got, I mean, you know, you got to give a diagnosis, right? But I always, unless I'm told differently, I always go with the, you know, the least intrusive, so to speak, diagnosis, meaning, okay, you know, some of the adjustment disorders, some of the
Yeah, resist the personality disorders.
resist, you know, yeah, resist some of the because things can follow people, right? And especially with kids, you know, who once they're out of the, you know, the environment, that environment, and they're in college or they've moved away or whatever, who we don't know what's going to happen, right? And so I appreciate you. It really resonated when you say about getting that multiple, you know, multiple sources of feedback. It really, you know, it really helps. And the other thing, going back, because this all started because of, you know, talking about that third construct, acquired capability. You know, what's funny is when we go back and look at the psychological autopsies that have been done of veterans, very some active duty service members, but as you know, a lot of the research is quantitative and it's focused on veterans, not active duty. But what we've seen is that the families don't realize it. The families they nope, they weren't gonna. And I share this story of Frank Estrada, a good friend of mine, 2 weeks before in August of 20, August 16th, 2023, 2 days before, 2 weeks before he's officially retired from the military. He went, came from his kid's birthday party on a Saturday, walked out in the garage, said he's gonna work on something, and hung himself. And I was like, okay, this totally changes everything. Because how does this happen? How does somebody, that's not easy. It's not easy to hang yourself, especially when you're you know, a bigger person, right? And and those biological responses to save yourself are going to kick in. So how does somebody, how do we, and then it made me think, what was we were always told, well, people are feeling suicidal or, you know, on that spectrum of suicidality, that they're going to be giving away stuff. They're going to be sad. They're going to be down, depressed, or hopeless. And then I realized, I was like, maybe early on, maybe in the early stages, but people, I think people like Frank, people that are in the later stages, right? Meaning they're pursuing, especially soldiers, right? Who have that acquired capability. Those elements of acquired capability.
And a good ability to separate the private and the public, right? I mean,
Oh
that's part of your
yes.
job.
Yeah. So they're carrying on and then it just, it's a course of action. It's just going to be implemented. And so it's what I thought about was, and that's why I came up, you know, with the hero mindset. I thought about it kind of from my background in IT and cybersecurity. Well, if I can re-engineer the malware, then we can have the output. And so I came up with, you know, kind of my purpose by that and watching this television show called Billions on HBO,
Great show.
and Dr. Wendy Rhodes. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want, that's my purpose. I want to work with people should perform at the absolute level, the absolute edge of their potential, whether that's you want to be, the next, Todd Kasdan, or you want to be the best, parent to your kids, whatever it is. That's how I want to approach it. Because I think too often, especially in therapy, and especially now with, people being able to practice at the bachelor's, and I'm not putting it down, it's because we have a lack of providers, but we got people, therapy has kind of become a commodity. And so what I want to be able to do is, and that's what turned me on to your research, is help people perform at that absolute edge of their potential, whatever that may be for them, instead of approaching it from a remedial standpoint. Because another story I'll share with you real quick is I don't, especially in high performing individuals, and you can share what you've seen in this to me, things present differently. I've had a couple people, well, one in particular, reach out to me and say, "Hey, I'm retired now. Do you know I got diagnosed with bipolar?" And I said, "That's well, I'm glad you're getting help." And then I thought, all this time we thought this guy, he was a senior person. We thought he was just mission oriented. He's just getting stuff done. We loved him because he always gets done. And he had a he had a diagnosable, a clinical issue. Things are going to present differently in different populations. And I think, maybe not, they're not underserved, but I think maybe an under, they're not assured because they have resources, right? So they're not like they're on the other side of the fence that you were talking about earlier. But they probably the they go unnoticed that they need help because they're just such high performers. So it's 20, now that I look back, I've probably been suffering with these symptoms for 10 years, but it wasn't until a year ago that somebody said, "Hey, maybe you should go get, I think you need to consider that maybe you're having some symptoms of PTSD." And because we don't, we just get so used to, we just are, we were resilient. We understand that you got to continue to try and move forward. And so we adopt these mechanisms, these coping mechanisms that get us through, but sometimes, but we don't realize that, the toll it's taking on us. And so that's nice. That kind of relates back to your initial analogy about the games, right?
Yeah, I mean, those are two very intense stories with very different lessons that come from them. I mean, the first one, which is so tragic, which is what did he need? What did he want? What did he want to be doing that his life that was not going? He's got the whole family, made it through the military, and then so you have that whole arm of questions, which is not about mental health problems. It's basically about like what assets, what did you. What assets and aspirations? What did you want to do? And then the second one is, you have this
Well,
leader
let
who.
me interject there real quick. The army was his gang, I mean, when we think
Right,
about those
right.
cohesive,
Yeah. And that's a connective tissue to the second story, which is so you're functioning at a high level as a high level leader in the military, but when this position stops, because by age it's going to happen, what are you going to do with this profile that's helping you now? And then this is the last scene of the Hurt Locker, the movie where basically he comes back from disarming IEDs and he comes back to civilian life, and then he has basically a mental health breakdown in the cereal aisle of a grocery store of like, this is my life, like trying to figure out which of 400 cereal choices
I
I'm gonna
was just
do.
gonna say that. Yes,
It's the most beautiful, to me, it's the most beautiful scene I've ever seen of like what military life is like, to understand. And
I'm gonna write that down. The Hurt Locker. I need to watch that again.
you can just go on YouTube for just the last scene. It's so powerful. And then all of a sudden the next scene is him going back to, I forgot if it was Afghanistan or Iraq. And then he's basically like he's there. He's an IED specialist again. It happens there. And so for the military veteran who's a leader with bipolar symptoms, it's working great. When you retire, how is this going to work? My concern is that it's going the disability is going to pop up possibly even more so for you. That
Yes, exactly. Sorry to interrupt. The
it
same
goes back to
with
your environment thought.
PTSD, right? The environment is masking some of the symptoms, or it's maybe it's even encouraging it. and not in a bad way, but it's pulling out the it's it, and once it's masking, in case of, like a bipolar one disorder, it's masking the manicness because we are in a high op tempo environment. So we you don't it doesn't stick out like the guy working at McDonald's who, it's easy to tell when he stays up all night making Big Macs.
Yeah, grad students is the same way. Like what people that are in grad school, it's if you have bipolar 1, 2, or 3, it's good to help you. I mean, I remember having a mentor who recently passed away, William Pelham, one of the best ADHD researchers ever. And then I was in his office as a second or third year grad student, and I asked him for a letter to apply for some silly award, and then he's like, the only reason you're going to be more successful than other people is because you're hypomanic. And I remember I took it as like a compliment and an insult at the same time, because like I didn't internalize it. It's not really me, it's this thing inside me that just does the stuff, lots of stuff that goes in there. But it's interesting to have a mental health professional who is decades older than me that did not say ask a question, which was, hey, how do you think this helps you? How do you think it's going to hurt you? Because that would have been an interesting conversation that we didn't have.
Well, I mean, it's the same for CEOs and people in similar, environments, founders, people that are these things are going to mask a lot. So while there's people that are truly underserved, meaning they don't have access to the resources, we have people on the other end of the spectrum that are getting missed because their environments are masking it. And
Ooh, I
so
like this.
the same with me. So then when I got out, when I PCS back to the States and everything is quote unquote in a more normal environment and I'm not in Kuwait anymore, that's when and I'm walking into the headquarters building one day and I was like, why do I feel like the enemy's on the other side of that door? Why do I feel like why is my body like this? So it was at that change in the environment that allowed me to start seeing it for myself. Because for me, I was like, it's easy for somebody who's retired and sees me on a limited basis to say that, maybe I have it. I don't think I do. But then when I was out of the, out of that the environment changed, then I was able to see it. And so I think it also goes to the notion that a lot of these things, and this is in every, or most, I won't say every, then somebody will email me and be like, well, it's not on this one. But what's at the bottom of every, diagnosis in the DSM? It's clinically significant, social, occupational, impairment, right? And so I think that's the point. When these things, whether it's you're talking about gangs, or you're talking about people joining gangs, or we're talking about, like you said, working to, very super dedicated towards whether that's grad school or, to your organization if you're a CEO. A lot of these things, they're not bad, but when anything starts to prevent us from getting towards our goals or, accomplishing our objectives, that's when things become a problem. And I, that's when we need to, maybe look at and see what, maybe clinical interventions are available. But I just it's just very interesting because, in our profession there's a lot of focus on the remedial side of things. And I like to approach it from the side that, people aren't broken. They're just responding with the tools, that they believe they have in their toolkit. They're responding from, where the, what the resources that they have or don't have or their environment, but
You're making me think of an article that I'm in the middle of working on right now for my Substack, which is there is no elite performer. Like we're talking like as you're saying, these are the extreme margins. There's no elite performer that's normal. They don't
No.
have normal they don't have normal profile. I mean, just choose your favorite sport, choose your favorite icon, even if you're not so choose your favorite musician, like that goes in there. I mean, just these are not normal people. And I
Or a
say,
military leader,
yeah. And
Well,
I say in a good way, non-pejorative way.
Yeah.
Actually, the pejorative element here, this is more like a teaser. The pejorative element is really like society, is that the judgments that you're going to have about these people, especially like in the age of the interwebs,
Yeah.
is the thing you're going to see a little bit of a toe exposed of their personality. That's this is the upside of your dark side. You're
Yeah,
going to see a
yeah.
toe exposed of their dark side, and you're going to criticize the crap out of them. And I say to you and all the people that do this is they could not reach the levels they are having a normal profile. And so
No.
you're going to see some nasty toenails on a few toes. It's just the beginning of like what's in there. And the thing is you take that away, you take away the music, you take away the athletic brilliance, you take away the amazing artistry of what they wrote, you take away this amazing cinematography, and I want a world with more color and texture, and I'm willing to absorb
Yeah.
a little bit of that darkness. And so if you have a appreciation of the arts, the sciences, and great leadership and brilliance, you have to have an appreciation of some of the darkness.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, and I'm gonna look forward to that article. I think that's a great place to a great cliffhanger to leave the audience on today. I appreciate you joining us. I appreciate all you do for me, for the community, and thanks again for joining us.
Oh yeah, I mean, listen. TJ, you are a great storyteller, and I hope this reaches more people because your angle is the angle that more people need.
Thank you. I appreciate it.